Hi, welcome to The Halfling. I'm your host, Jaren Pack, and you're listening to Episode 4, Isildur and Numenor. I want to start this episode off with a little bit of a confession. One of my favorite things to do is play Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. Let me explain. As a kid, I remember sitting down with my friends to watch the three films over and over again. And every time we did so, there was a really good chance that we would tear it to shreds. Like, on every possible level. We'd read into awkward lines, point out overacting, criticize, and even invent plot holes. You get the idea. It wasn't like any of us truly hated the movies. I mean, come on, we were a bunch of insecure boys trying to boost our egos by ripping on the big guys up on the screen. Textbook childish behavior right there. Of course, the truth is, we all loved the movies. We loved the books. We loved the story. Even when we had our fake critic hats on, the fact still stands that we were obviously willing to get together and watch through all three movies. Sometimes all in a single sitting. I mean, that's like a dozen hours of movie watching, especially if you sit through the credits, which have like the entire population of New Zealand in them. Anyway, for all of those Mr. Hyde-inspired critical viewings, it's always fascinated me how easily I could flip a switch and approach things from the Dr. Jekyll point of view. I mean, I can still see all of the warts and various shortcomings throughout the films, but especially as I get older, I can just as easily spend all day praising the films as monumental pieces of cinema. They're gorgeous to watch, iconically well-acted, and they really do follow an impressively articulate storyline. Even if you dig into a source material comparison, I'm ready to flip that switch either way. I'll attack creative decisions, like replacing poor Glorfindel, till my dying breath. But I'm also the first person to point out that getting all of this to make sense is really overwhelming. I mean, adapting the books, which are filled with things like detailed conversations and inner dialogue, is a Herculean task. It's one that can never be pulled off more than adequately. And for that, I praise Peter Jackson and company for their efforts and the immensely enjoyable results. Okay, why bring all this up? Because I want to set the stage for our next series by pointing out a pair of scenes from The Fellowship of the Ring that outline this back-and-forth struggle between criticism and praise. The first one, well, this is really a two-parter, comes halfway through the movie when Elrond recalls a scared-looking dude called Isildur as he desperately cuts the One Ring off of Sauron's hand with the shards of his father's sword. After that, everyone's favorite elvish counselor takes him up to Mount Doom, where he strongly advises him, and I mean strongly advises him, to chuck the bauble into the lava lake below. Suddenly gone cold, Isildur replies, "No," before smiling and walking off, giving his elven companion the cold shoulder. Jerk. This memory sequence connects directly to another scene from the beginning of the film, where we see Isildur go on from there to lose the ring on his way back home. When he gets ambushed by orcs, the guy reverts right back to his fearful ways, pops on the ring, ditches his soldiers, and then loses his newfound jewelry in a river before he's shot to death in the water. A gruesome end for a pathetic dude, right? Okay, now the other scene I want to point out comes at the end of the movie. As Frodo heads for the boats to leave the Fellowship behind and make for Mordor on his own, don't worry, Sam catches him before he can leave. Anyway, while Frodo makes a break for it, Aragorn and his companions stay busy as they duke it out with a bunch of halfling-hunting Uruk-hai. At one point, Aragorn flings himself onto a group of his enemies. As he does this, he shouts something. The Uruk-hai fall underneath him and just lay there, apparently slain by his... weight? Sorry, Mr. Hyde coming through there for a second. Anyway, as Aragorn leaps upon his foes, he shouts the single name, Elendil. This war cry sounds epic, and it strikes fear in his enemies. But for viewers, especially those who haven't read the books, it doesn't mean much. Who on Middle-earth is Elendil? Why is Aragorn shouting his name while he jumps a column of his enemies in battle? Alright, here are where those two scenes connect. It turns out that Elendil is none other than Isildur's dad. That's right, Elendil is the guy whose sword is broken and used by his son to cut the One Ring from Sauron's hand. That same sword eventually finds its way into the hands of his descendant, Aragorn, thousands of years later. So, why bring all this up? Well, I'll tell you why. In fact, I'll give you the TLDR version right here. Aragorn's claim to the throne of Gondor goes directly through Elendil and his son Isildur. In fact, Those ancestors are really important leaders of men who arrive in Middle-earth an entire age before the events of The Lord of the Rings. They found the sister kingdoms of Gondor and Arnor. Eventually, they even join up with a bunch of elves and take down Sauron. Throughout all of this, Elendil maintains a sort of legendary hero status. He's untouchable, holy historical ground, so to speak. But his second-in-command, Isildur, is also a brave, courageous, and noble warrior. That's right, Isildur's a hero, too. No matter what the movies make him out to look like, he is a hero. Sure, he's got his low points, but I can say with complete confidence that he is one of Middle-earth's bona fide good guys. It's also worth pointing out here that he's yet another candidate who's heavily rumored to show up in Amazon's show in a pretty big way. So, over the next few episodes, we're going to dig into who Isildur is. And in the process, I really want to debunk this Peter Jackson stereotype of Isildur as a one-dimensional, selfish, cowardly, pig-headed guy. Don't get me wrong, we're going to see some serious character flaws and some even worse decision-making. But I think when all's said and done, we're also going to discover a character who, in spite of his flaws, is very much so the classic definition of a hero. In fact, for those of you who think Tolkien's writings only consist of linear good versus bad content, Isildur's a great example of how deep and well-rounded his characters can be. Now, if we're going to cover Isildur's story the right way, we're going to need to spend the rest of this episode laying out some critical background info. So I'm going to need you to bear with me. As is so often the case in Tolkien's deeply complex world, if we want Isildur's story to make any sense, we need to start the journey by backing way up to well before the man himself is even born. From there, we'll trace Isildur's story from the beginning and figure out why he, his father, and their family are such important people in the first place, and how their presence becomes a major influence on the course of Middle-earth history. Alright, let's do this thing. A long time ago, in an ocean far, far away, there was an island. Okay, it wasn't that far away. I'm talking about the island of Numenor, located off of the southwestern coast of Middle-earth. For anyone listening who can picture that classic Middle-earth map in your head, we're talking about a location far below Gondor and way out into the water on the left. The island nation of Numenor is a fascinating bit of Middle-earth geography, because it's a really big deal during the Second Age of Middle-earth, even though it literally doesn't exist in the First and Third Ages that bookend it. Like, literally, the dirt and rocks aren't even there. How's that possible? Well, do you remember the Valar? They're those complicated spiritual guardians of Middle-earth that we heard about during our time with good old Glorfindel. They're often referred to as angelic beings, even though that's a bit of a simplification. Anyway, at the beginning of the Second Age, those overpowered guys get together and decide to give a gift to a group of men called the Edain, who help them defeat the Dark Lord Morgoth at the end of the First Age. Now, I know that's a lot of names, but suffice it to say, the Valar are grateful to some men, so they look for a way to give them a gift that's only possible for spiritual guardians of the world to give. They decide that the best thing that they can do is give them a peaceful place to live, which, hey, I'd take that if it was on the table. So they raise this island up out of the waves, because, yeah, they can do that kind of thing. They create this utopian landmass. It's a paradise with solid rock underfoot, rich soil on top, flowers, fountains, the works. They then lead the Edain to the island, and over the next several centuries, that group becomes one of Tolkien's greatest kingdoms of men ever. Full stop. Their nation is eventually called Numenor, and the people are called, you guessed it, the Numenorians. Now, just for a little perspective, Numenor is not a small island. In Unfinished Tales, it says that the area resembled a five-point star. The middle section of the island, so not counting the 5 points, is 250 miles across. So we're not talking about a little mound of sand with a single slightly offset palm tree and coconut in the middle of it. This is a considerable chunk of idyllic real estate. It has coastlands and inlands, mountains and flat areas. It's basically its own little ecosystem. And it's the cradle of civilization for this nation called Numenor. Oh, and if you're wondering why this island isn't around when the Second Age ends, I'm afraid you'll have to be patient. We'll get to that part in detail in the next episode. Now, the Second Age is almost 3,500 years long, and over this time, the sheltered Numenorians become incredibly powerful. They're also ruled by a line of kings that starts with a guy named Elros, who happens to be the brother of Elrond himself. The brothers have elven and human ancestors, and they're allowed to choose which race's fate they want for themselves. For more on that topic, check out the second episode of the series on Glorfindel. Elros chooses to live his life out as a king of men, but he's gifted an extraordinarily long life and lives exactly 500 years. After that, his descendants' lives are shorter, but still really long. Even Aragorn, who's directly descended from Elros, lives to be well over 200 years old. Now, if you're wondering what all of this has to do with our boy Isildur, don't worry. It'll all come together here in just a second. As the Second Age plays out, Numenor goes from an upstart kingdom to one of the premier powers in Middle-earth. In this process, its kings slowly shift from grateful rulers to men who take their gifts for granted. A few of them still rule well, but many of them begin envying elves and searching for immortality. Alright, now let's fast forward to a couple of centuries before the end of the Second Age. 3,209 years into the Second Age, a baby boy named Isildur is born into a popular branch of the royal family. They're not the kings themselves, but directly related to them, so legit royalty. The head of the family is called the Lord of Adúniae, and they rule over a portion of the island. In the Silmarillion, it says that, quote, "Highest in honor after the house of the kings were the lords of Adúniae, for they were of the line of Elros," end quote. It also says, quote, "And the lord of Adúniae was ever among the chief counselors of the scepter. Yet also from the beginning they bore a special love to the Eldar and reverence for the Valar," end quote. So, basically, Isildur's family is a very important branch of the royals, and the young nobleman presumably grows up nice and comfortable as an upper-crust member of the world's strongest nation. Now, I know we've barely talked about Isildur himself so far, but all of this background was important. It sets the stage, and to be honest, this is a pretty complicated part of the story for anyone who hasn't tackled the Silmarillion before. I wanted to make sure that we covered everything first so that I don't start just flinging names and dates at you without any context. So, to recap everything up to this point, at the beginning of the Second Age, the Valar create an island and gift it to a group of men, who quickly grow into the powerful nation of Numenor. This nation is ruled by a line of long-lived kings founded by Elrond's mortal brother, Elros. When Isildur arrives over 3,000 years later, he's born into a branch of the royal family that serves as key counselors to the kings of the island. Now, I hope that makes sense, at least somewhat, because it's going to be an important backdrop for Isildur's story, which we'll have to pick up in full force first thing next week. That's it for now. Until next time, friends. This episode is brought to you by, well, me. And despite the fact that I've memorized whole chunks of Tolkien at this point, it still takes quite a bit of work to pull each of these together. There are also some recurring expenses that come with keeping the show on the air. So, if you're interested in helping, I set up a way to toss a few dollars toward covering costs. Just go to buymeacoffee.com/thehalfling. That's buymeacoffee.com/thehalfling. If you make a donation, thank you very much. And either way, I hope you'll stick around for all the fun. All right, that's it for now. Until next time, friends.